Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 14 hours GMT on Monday, the 5th of August, these are our main stories. Running battles on the streets of Hong Kong as pro-democracy campaigners clash with police. Pakistani fury at India's decision to end the self-governing status of the disputed state of Kashmir. The families of those killed in the El Paso Walmart shooting have been taking part in vigils there. Also in this podcast,
I got lucky. Suddenly, Lisbon became the trendy city of Europe, and I was able to ride that wave.
8 years ago, the Portuguese economy was in chaos. It's now experiencing its highest growth in two decades. We find out what's behind the boom. There have been mass protests across Hong Kong today. In some of the most wide-ranging demonstrations in the territory's growing crisis, pro-democracy activists have brought much of the territory to a standstill. Several hundred flights have been cancelled and morning commuter trains disrupted. Our correspondent, Stephen McDonald, spoke to me from the middle of the intensifying clashes.
I am wearing a gas mask still, but the other one I had on is an indication of how dangerous this can be. It was hit straight in the face by a projectile from the police. It could be, I suppose, a tear gas canister or a rubber bullet or something. Luckily, I had the mask on, or it would have hit me, straight, as I say, straight smack in the face. Shows how dangerous it can be, partly because it's a very fluid situation. At one moment, the protesters are all charging in a certain direction, like they are right now, back towards the right. Police are retreating. And at other times, the riot police will attack, and they'll come at different directions because they'll try and flank the protesters. Now, what started this particular clash is that protesters were gathering outside the compound where the police live, spray painting on the outside that the mafia lives in here. This is a reference to the allegations from these activists that they're colluding with triad gangs who were bashing up activists. Of course, the police deny this, and that's why one of the demands today from the general strike, or they're saying is a general strike, the widespread strike at least, is to have an independent inquiry into police collusion with organised crime. Now, the government says there's no need to have that because they say the police are investigating this matter themselves.
So, Stephen, people out on the streets, the wider population, though, how many of them took part in the general strike? What is the feeling of the people in Hong Kong?
It depends how you measure participation, because all around Hong Kong there are shops closed, shutters pulled down, many businesses, small and large, have not been able to open today. Flights in their hundreds have been delayed or cancelled. The subway system has at times been brought to a complete stop. They've blockaded the Cross Harbour Tunnel. So perhaps some people stayed home because they just couldn't get to work. But wherever you go in Hong Kong, There is this strike. You can't get away from it, as opposed to the other protests. That there's no way of, there are scenes like the one where I'm sitting now, all over the city. And here, there'd be a few thousand pro-democracy demonstrators having running street battles with the riot police. And there would be 10 places in the city where this is happening right now. There's a big problem the police force now has in terms of regaining the respect of this city, because we've been seeing ordinary citizens who are not part of the official protest movement haranguing the police, abusing them, and the government is not able to easily turn this around. It's a very big problem for the administration of Carrie Lam.
Stephen McDonald. The Himalayan region of Kashmir is a disputed territory between India and Pakistan, with each country claiming it in full but controlling only part of it. For the past 70 years, the Indian-administered part of the region, known as Jammu and Kashmir, has had a special status, giving its 12 million-strong population substantial autonomy. Now, in an unprecedented move, the Indian Interior Minister, Amit Shah, has told Parliament the government is revoking Article 370 of the Constitution, which gives Kashmir that special status.
अनुच्छेद 370 के खंड 3 द्वारा प्रदत्त शक्तियों का प्रयोग करते हुए
Opposition members of parliament voiced outrage, drowning out the announcement. Our correspondent in Delhi, Yogita Lemurier, told me about the reasons behind the Indian government's decision.
Well, it was one of the BJP's big election promises. It was a huge part of their manifesto. It's been something that they've said they believe in for a very long time now. They've said that, you know, Kashmir should not have this special status in India. And now that they won the election with such a huge mandate, I think they saw the opportunity to do so. So that might be the reason behind the timing, because it's been a big part of their manifesto. On the ground, essentially what this article did is that it gave more autonomy to the region of Kashmir, to the state of Kashmir in India than any other state. Apart from issues like defense, external affairs and communications, the state could make its own decisions. But under this article also, there was a section 35A, and that gave some special rights and privileges to the people of this region. Permanent residents were the only ones allowed to buy property in the area. And so critics of the move to revoke this article say that this is part of the BJP's Hindu nationalist agenda to try and change the demographic of India's only Muslim majority state.
There are questions about its legality. The measure was announced in Parliament and not voted on by MPs. And this is India's constitution we're talking about.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's exactly why you saw that uproar in Parliament. MPs shouting, saying that, you know, there had been no debate. They had not been notified that this would be discussed in Parliament today. I also spoke to someone who actually worked as an interlocutor for a previous government with the people of Kashmir. And according to him, he says he doesn't think democratic process have been followed. He doesn't think the constitution has been followed. He believes that there will certainly be a legal challenge, that someone will petition the Supreme Court about the legality of this decision today. But most importantly, what he says is that, you know, if the people of Kashmir, if there were, you know, any people in the region who would have chosen to be a part of India, who would have preferred to be a part of India than Pakistan, then today what the government has done, is that they've broken their trust because of the manner in which all of this has been conducted.
Yogita Lemurier in Delhi. Meanwhile, Pakistan called India's announcement illegal. Speaking to the BBC, the country's foreign minister, Shah Mahmood Qureshi, said India had no right to make unilateral decisions over Kashmir.
Kashmir is a recognised international dispute. India has recognised and accepted it as a dispute, and that is why they included it in the comprehensive dialogue that we've had, as one of the outstanding issues between India and Pakistan.
Our correspondent Asif Farooqi is in Islamabad.
Pakistani foreign minister has made it very, very clear that Pakistan will go to the international community once again after what India has done today. As you know, this all started in the UN, where Pakistan and India went to discuss this or resolve this problem 70 years ago. And there have been more than a dozen resolutions around the Kashmir dispute between the two countries. And Pakistani authorities are very, very clear on it that Pakistan has a very strong case, or in fact, Kashmiris have a very strong case if they go back to the international community, talking not just about the human rights violation that they allege, but also the change of status that was promised by India under the constitution and in the resolution in the UN that they have taken back. So Pakistani government has called or convened a joint session of the parliament tomorrow to discuss what modalities and what actions Pakistan can actually take.
Asif Farooqi. Families out shopping at a supermarket, people out to enjoy themselves in bars and restaurants, they became victims of more mass shootings in the United States, where 20 were left dead in Texas, 9 more in Ohio on Saturday. Families of those killed in El Paso have been taking part in vigils there. One of those was held at Ponder Park, just a few hundred yards from where the massacre took place. Sophie Long was there.
It began with Mexican drummers dressed in their traditional vibrant red and yellow, escorting a candlelit procession of multi-faith religious leaders. Each took their turn to offer words of healing to the crowds that had gathered.
Let us show the world El Paso in the days ahead, in the months ahead. Let us show them why we love this place. Let us show them why we love our neighbors on both sides of this river.
That love, always, every time, will win. Every single time.
Te lo pedimos todo por Cristo, nuestro Señor. Amén.
There must be thousands of people here now. Those who couldn't fit in are sitting in the stands and peering through the fence that surrounds the baseball diamond. Many of them are wearing T-shirts that say El Paso Strong. Some in Spanish, some in English. Others are wearing big yellow badges that simply say Hope. Many tears have been shed here tonight for the 20 who aren't here and for the great loss this community has suffered. But there have also been songs of celebration and there have been cheers.
There's nothing like El Paso.
Cheers for a city that bridges communities, and that, as those in the crowd told me, will never change.
Was to begin the healing process for the community. There are so many people that will be affected forever, not just the ones whose family members were killed or they have people that are injured, but also the young man from Walmart who helped rescue folks was in tears as he walked out. He's going to need a lot of help.
This will not change El Paso. This will make El Paso stronger because we are a community of faith. We are a community of hope. We are a community of unity.
Amazing grace. There was no talk here of hate, of race or racism, no talk of anger or manifestos or failings of political leaders. This was a celebration of a city, its people, with prayers for those left with broken hearts and wounds yet to heal.
I was lost, but now I'm found. 'Twas blind, but now I see.
That report from Sophie Long in El Paso. Meanwhile, in the aftermath of the deadly shootings, there have been accusations that President Trump has incited such hate crimes with inflammatory rhetoric against immigrants and people of colour. The president has fiercely denied any responsibility, saying hate has no place in America. The authorities have already taken steps to close down a website that publicised the white nationalist document justifying the shootings in El Paso, supposedly written, the authorities think, by the killer. Our business and technology correspondent Theo Leggett told me more.
Well, 8chan is a web forum where people can go to post messages and swap ideas and content pretty much like any other, and if you know about it, you can find out how to get on it. But this one is notorious because of the kind of extremist material that appears on it and the kind of unrestrained discussion that takes place, particularly between members of the far right. In fact, it's the site that people have gone to from other very controversial websites when they started clamping down on this kind of stuff. Now, the suspect in the El Paso shooting is believed to have posted a lengthy so-called manifesto on the site railing against immigrants before the shootings began, and it wasn't the first time this had happened. The perpetrators of previous shootings are also believed to have posted on the site beforehand as well. And this is where another company called Cloudflare comes into it. Cloudflare is a private organisation. Its role was to protect 8chan's site from cyber attack. So it's a middleman, and it was there to protect against things like what's known as a distributed denial of service attack, in which networks of computers are used to focus on a single site or system with huge numbers of requests for connection or information in order to overwhelm it and take it offline. So Cloudflare was acting as this middleman, filtering access to the site, protecting it. But the chief executive, Matthew Prince, has said this won't happen anymore. He described 8chan as a cesspool of hate and said he would withdraw Cloudflare's services in future. And as a result, over the past couple of hours, 8chan has actually been down.
Theo Leggett. It's been more than 3 months since a fire devastated the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, and there's growing concern about toxic pollution caused by the blaze. Hundreds of tons of lead burned on the night of April the 15th, and areas surrounding the building have registered very high levels of lead contamination. Earlier today, there was a news conference in Paris about the problem. Our reporter David Chazan told me what was said.
Environmental groups and trade unions demanded that the entire cathedral site be completely closed off while the area is given a deep clean, the idea being to remove all lead pollution before any further reconstruction. They also called for a special lead contamination centre to be set up as a local hospital and for more public information about exactly how much lead there is in the local area. They said there should be more systematic testing of people who may have suffered forms of lead poisoning, especially pregnant women and children in the area who are particularly vulnerable. And this comes amid general public concern about the hundreds of firefighters who put out the fire on the night, and also about construction workers on the site. In fact, work has been suspended until next week to allow better lead decontamination procedures to be put in place.
Yeah, schools have been closed. What is the risk to health here?
Well, the authorities continue to insist that the risk is pretty low. Nevertheless, schools in the neighbourhood are being checked for lead and they're being given a deep clean during the summer holidays. One school that had been continued to be used as a children's holiday centre during the summer break was closed. But nevertheless, the authorities say that dangerous levels of lead have not been detected in schools. They say the deep clean is just a precaution and children's health has not been endangered. However, astronomical levels of toxic lead were measured in the immediate area around Notre Dame at the time of the fire, and they remain high in some parts of the cathedral, particularly and also in the ground of the adjacent park and forecourt. Now, these areas have been closed to the public since the fire, and they're likely to remain closed for years to come.
David Chazan in Paris. Still to come in this podcast.
Their mothers are in ICU and there are some who have been dumped. And us, we have a lot of milk. We breastfeed and some of it remains and is wasted.
A human breast milk bank is lending a helping hand to vulnerable infants. 8 years ago, the Portuguese economy was in such crisis it had to be bailed out by the European Union. But now, it's experiencing its highest growth in two decades. So what's behind the boom and is it sustainable? Lisa Luis reports from Portugal.
El Clandestino, a Mexican restaurant bar in Lisbon's Bairro Alto, is part of Portugal's economic success story. It's one of five bars João Batista has opened since 2011. Because when the economy started to hit rock bottom nearly a decade ago, tourists began arriving in ever-increasing numbers.
I got lucky. Suddenly, Lisbon became the trendy city of Europe, and I was able to ride that wave.
Nobody believed that the economy would stay contracting.
But the economic growth from tourism might not be sustainable, says Pedro Brinca, professor for macroeconomics at Lisbon's Nova Universidade.
Tourism is a highly volatile phenomena. Other countries can become the new fashion destination. And we benefited a lot from the Arab Spring. Arab Spring turmoil is bound to go away. As soon as Tunisia's tourism industry starts bouncing back, people start going back to Egypt and Turkey.
And the country has another problem, its rapidly aging population.
Even if we come up with policies that can allow the younger generations to have families, they will only take effect on the labor markets in the next 20 years. So, to address the transitional problem, the only way I see is migration.
The government is working on plugging the labor market hole. It wants to attract more foreign workers, take in more refugees, and bring back the hundreds of thousands of Portuguese who left during the crisis. It is fast-tracking high-tech and startup visas and offering financial support to homecoming Portuguese from this year on.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Lisa Luis from the BBC.
Nice meeting you.
Pedro Cisa Vieira is Portugal's Minister of Economy.
It is crucial that we are capable of securing this inflow of people. Young people departed because the economy is not providing sufficiently attractive jobs. That landscape is changing. The country needs them. Their work is now valued, and refugees will be also welcome.
And are the government initiatives enough to bring native Portuguese workers back home? In France, the biggest Portuguese diaspora in the world has grown further since the crisis. Project manager Richard Tavares arrived from Aveiro in northern Portugal a few years ago. He could benefit from the new government measures for homecomers, but he says moving back is out of the question.
I don't think people will decide to go back because of this program. Wages are a lot higher abroad, and there are a lot more stable jobs here. If someone goes back, it's for personal reasons.
With rents and prices going up steadily in Portugal and wages stagnating, the saudade, nostalgic longing for home, might still be Portugal's best way to convince its people to return.
Lisa Louise, the Chinese currency has fallen to its lowest level against the dollar in more than a decade as hopes fade for a swift resolution of the trade war between Beijing and Washington. The yuan has breached the level of 7 against the dollar. Karishma Vaswani reports.
China's central bank said protectionism and tariffs are to blame for the currency's weakness without specifically mentioning the United States. The Chinese currency is not freely traded. The central bank there sets a guiding point for it every day, signaling to the market where it wants the yuan to go. Analysts say the weakness in the yuan could be China's way of fighting back against President Trump's latest tariffs on $300 billion worth of Chinese goods, which are expected to start in September. A weaker yuan means that Chinese goods are cheaper to buy for American consumers.
Karishma Vaswani with that report. Between a quarter and a third of all greenhouse gas emissions are now estimated to come from land use. Today, scientists are teaming up with government officials in Geneva to finalise their most authoritative report yet on the way we use and abuse land. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is expected to warn people about the effects of irresponsible farming and forest cutting. Our environment analyst Roger Harabin reports from the east of England.
It's just after dawn, and Wickham Fen in Cambridgeshire is already buzzing with life. This National Trust Reserve is what remains of a great fenland, a soggy peat bog that used to sprawl right across East Anglia. The Romans began to drain it, and over the centuries it's been almost completely replaced by farming on the dark, soft soil. Great for crop yields, but terrible for wildlife and soil loss. And also, this is probably less well known, terrible for climate change. Sarah Smith is manager of Wickham Fen Reserve. Why so, Sarah?
So what we have here at Wickham Fen is one of the last remaining fragments of undrained fenland in East Anglia. And what comes with that undrained fen is up to 4 metres depth of peat. And that peat is an enormous store of carbon. It's been growing there for millennia. When that peat is drained, as much of it has been for agriculture in the Cambridgeshire fens, the peat shrinks and it oxidises, and that carbon is released into the atmosphere. And what we see here at the Fen is where we have 4 metres of peat in the undrained areas, on some of the newer areas that have been former agricultural fields, we've got as little as 50 centimetres of that peat left. Because we see between 1 and 2 centimetres of peat is lost every year.
And sorry, let me just stop you. Between 1 and 2 centimetres every year is lost?
Between 1 and 2 centimetres every year.
And the carbon from that goes straight into the atmosphere?
Straight into the atmosphere, that's right.
Roger Harabin with that report. Pumwani Maternity Hospital in Kenya's capital, Nairobi, is the biggest in the country, with nearly 100 live births every single day. It's made headlines in the past for all the wrong reasons. The discovery of 12 dead babies wrapped in polythene bags last year was shocking. But a recently opened human breast milk bank is lending a helping hand to vulnerable infants. The BBC's Andrew Ochieng reports.
Jerusha and I washes her hands thoroughly under a cold water tap inside the newborn unit of Pumwani Maternity Hospital. She's one of hundreds of women who gave birth here just a few days ago. Dressed in a roughly tied traditional wrap, she's preparing to donate her excess breast milk. This hospital was selected as the site of the pilot for the Human Milk Bank because of the high number of baby deaths. Around 540 baby deaths were recorded here annually, according to one study. As Jerusha attaches a breast pump inside one of the brightly decorated private booths, she tells me why she's donating her milk.
I decided to donate milk because we were told by the nurses about babies who are suffering. They don't have parents. Their mothers are in ICU and there are some who have been dumped. And us, we have a lot of milk. We breastfeed and some of it remains and is wasted. It's better to donate it, to help others.
That's why Pumwani was chosen as the first milk bank in East Africa. It's an attempt by donor partners, including the UK government's Programme for Appropriate Technology in Health, to lower the mortality rate. Inside the operation room, two nurses are marking bottles of the breast milk that has already been donated. They're putting coloured stickers on top of the bottles. I can see orange ones. And just like the traffic signs, there are red, green and orange, and of course meaning exactly the same things. Red meaning the milk has not yet been tested, orange meaning the milk is in the process of being tested, and green meaning the milk is ready to be given to the infants. Faith Njeru is one of the nurses who works in the milk bank, and she explains how they recruit donors from the hospital's labor wards. On average, there are six women who donate milk at the facility every single day.
And the first thing that they are led to know is that this is voluntary. They're not going to be paid any amount of money, and a screening process will be done. That is basically the screening in the laboratory for their blood, that is HIV, syphilis, hepatitis B and C. And then they are taken through a consent. They have to sign a consent just to agree that they volunteer themselves to donate this milk. And once they donate, this milk is not going to be given back to them and the hospital is not going to pay them. Mm-hmm. What we anticipate when we are recruiting them, you have to be feeding your own baby first. Your baby is full and you have a surplus of more than 30 mls in a feed.
Since it was started 3 months ago, the unit has provided milk to 51 babies and has 123 registered donors. It cost around $600,000 to establish. The hospital is now a formula-free zone, with money saved by not having to buy powdered milk.
Andrew Ocheng in Nairobi. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.